Something that we haven't looked at before is the Ten Commandments. Right? What is the... Always pays to understand roots and basics, because out of there develops all the wisdom of any subject. So maybe we can start working our way through understanding the Ten Commandments. So what I'd like to do is, first of all, say a few words about the structure, the background. We did discuss this in detail under the heading of honoring parents. So I'm not going to repeat the whole discussion, but just put it in context, and then begin this evening, if we can, maybe with at least the first of the ten, and hopefully we'll be able to work our way through through the structure of Ten Commandments. I think the first question to ask really is, why are there ten? But two basic questions. One is, why are there Ten Commandments? Or rather, why is there a set of commandments that's isolated or selected out of Torah? And secondly, of course, why these ten? Right? If these are somehow more important in some way, why is not, you know, coveting people's objects? Why does that merit to be in the top ten? I mean, I'm not saying it's not important, of course, but you have 613 mitzvahs in the Torah, some of them obviously very weighty. And here you have a mitzvah of not coveting, and according to many opinions, it means not even wanting. According to some opinions, as we'll try to see when we go through them, it means not making a move to get that person's object or his home or his whatever it is. But according to one opinion, there is certainly a prohibition of even wanting. How does that... First of all, how do you do that? How do you control the desire? But a basic question is, why is that one of the ten? And you could really ask about a number of the ten. Why these ten? Another question we could ask is really why they're divided into two sets of five. Right? Why there are two sets of five? And specifically with reference to honoring parents, the way we put it was, if you look carefully, you will notice that the two sets of five have two different subjects entirely. The first five of the Ten Commandments are what we call Ben Adam Lamakom. That means mitzvahs between man and God, between humans and Hashem. And the second five are really what we call Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. That means between what you call interpersonal mitzvahs, right? That's very clear. The first five of the commandments are Emunah, that means belief in Hashem, not committing idolatry, which is the opposite of that, keeping Shabbat, which is really an acknowledgement of Hashem's creation of the world, not taking His name in vain, whatever that means, we'll have to see. Those are really all pretty obviously mitzvahs that govern my relationship with Hashem. And the second five are very clearly mitzvahs that govern my relationship with you. Not killing, not stealing, not committing adultery, not falsely testifying against another human being, not wanting another human being's possessions. They're very clearly five that are interpersonal. The mysterious one is honoring parents, right? And we went through that before. Why is honoring parents in the first set of five, namely the mitzvahs that I have that govern or regulate my relationship with Hashem, when really the fifth of those is my relationship with my parents, right? After all, parents are human. Not that every child would admit that, you know, most of the time, but parents are just a specific example of human beings. So why does the Torah consider honoring parents, right, under the heading of your relationship with God rather than your relationship with people? But however we'll handle that question, it's very clear that the first five are man-God mitzvahs. The fifth of them is a junctional zone that moves in to relationship of people with each other. And you have to understand that this why are these five the ones that govern totally or more important in my relationship with Hashem than other, why are these the selected ones? So let's try to approach that this evening and see, you know, it's something we take so for granted, the Ten Commandments. You know, it's like, even in the non-Jewish world, very often those are acknowledged as the source of morality. I don't know if you know, there was a case in the southern United States a few months ago. Did you read about it? Where the courthouse has a statue of Moses with the Ten Commandments. Right? There's a big legal battle to have it removed from the courthouse. Right? Because yes, on the one hand, it is the basis of Western morality. On the other hand, it's religion. It's religion, right? And the secular law, what's a you know, what's a Jewish religious or biblical religious symbol doing in a court of law? Of course, in Judaism, there's no dichotomy. Our law is our morality and our religion. It is all one thing. But even there, they have the Ten Commandments. Incidentally, why do we depict them as we do? You know, wherever you go in the Jewish world, you'll see they're pictured as two slabs of stone with rounded tops. You know, the Gemara is clear that they did not have rounded tops. They were two slabs of stone, right? They were luchot ha'even, which were slabs of stone, which were cubic. They were square, cubic. They measured six tfachim, which is about this measurement, in fact, right? Specifically, they were that long, right? Made out of solid stone. They were bored through. They definitely did not have rounded tops. Wherever you go in the Jewish world, you'll see they're depicted, almost every shul in the world, every Jewish place, you'll see two tablets with round tops. But the symbolism, the sensitive symbolism here, is that is a childlike depiction of a heart. These two tablets are supposed to be the tablets of the heart, right? Like it says, Kasvem aluach libecha, katvem aluach libecha, carve them or write them on the tablets of your heart. And that is really a depiction of two tablets of stone, but given that childlike convention that shows that really it's not carved in stone out there. It's supposed to be carved in the stony heart, really, and convert that into a heart of flesh. Let's try to begin to understand something about these ten. You know, we take it so for granted. We have such bad misconceptions. Most people think, well, he couldn't carry them all. You know, after all, he was only human, Moses. So he came down from the mountain. So Hashem gave him like a sample. This is like a taster, you know, sort of a sample, 10, you know. Moshe Rabbeinu brought down the Torah. Obviously, in those 10, he was carrying the whole Torah. But then again, why were these singled out? The secret is this. These 10 are not more important in the sense of being philosophically fundamental. That means that if I asked you to break the Jewish religion down and stack it, construct it on its fundamentals, these are not the 10 you would choose. You may choose 13 articles of faith, that in fact the Rambam does. Maimonides lists 13 articles of faith, what we call the 13 ikrim, and ikar means a root. And those are fundamental. They're philosophically fundamental. They have other roots, other reasons why they are posited. But they are really fundamentals. Yes, it so happens that the first one or the first set really are governing or defining or in a way synonymous with Emunah, which is the first of the Ten Commandments, but the list is very different. The list of the 13 articles of faith includes resurrection of the dead. That doesn't appear in the Ten Commandments. The concept of reward and punishment. The concept that God knows what's doing with our actions and our thoughts. There are 13 articles of faith in Judaism that you could make a very convincing argument are the fundamentals of our practice. Right? As a side question, which we're not going to deal with this evening, where did those 13 come from? They're not the 13 things. He didn't bring down 13 things from the mountain. Not only that, if you look through the whole text of the Torah, you won't find 13 things listed. So how come we have this creedal statement on which Judaism stands, these 13 things, where they come from? That's an interesting question. Some other time we can deal with that. But that you will not find in the text of the Torah, and you'd be hard put to find it in the text of the Mishnah. And yet, if you want to argue that Judaism stands on 13 belief points, if you like, you could present those. They're not 10 commandments. So what are the Ten Commandments? They're not philosophically fundamental. They're not necessarily more important or weighty or more punishable than anything else in the Torah. Not necessarily. I'm not sure that coveting carries a more serious punishment than some of the than cheating people in business or taking interest in a loan or other prohibitions in the Torah. But the clue is this. The Ten Commandments are not philosophically fundamental so much, but they are the categories into which all else in the Torah fits. That means the Torah is a hierarchy of structure, and there are 10 categories from which you can derive all the others. When he came down from the mountain, he wasn't carrying a sample of 10. He was carrying 10 that contain all 613. Each of those 10 is the root of a group of mitzvahs, and if you know how, you could trace. In fact, there are works that show how each mitzvah in the Torah is rooted in one of the 10 commandments. You realize, of course, that all the 10 are rooted in the first two, and which are the ones we heard personally from Hashem, and both of the first two are rooted in the first one. And let's just spend a moment understanding this. I don't want to repeat this in great detail because we did it when we discussed honoring parents, but just very briefly, the fundamental point to know is that the Torah is always All Torah processes are an organic unfolding sequence. Again, there are two kinds of lists that you can make in the world. You can list items that have nothing to do with each other, that don't give rise to each other. For example, you make a list of clients on your business or telephone numbers. Each telephone number stands alone. The first telephone number on your list has got nothing to do with the second. That's not the way Torah works. The way Torah works always is that the first item on a list in Torah contains all the rest. It's the root and seed of all that will come thereafter. The second set in a list in Torah is always born from the first, but it's the root and seed of all that will come thereafter. And gradually the process will unfold itself until only the very last one on the list will have nothing in but itself. The analogy that you cannot afford to miss here is that's how a child is conceived. When the father's and mother's genes fuse, in that instant is laid down the totality of the future of the child. What then happens as the embryo develops in pregnancy is a result of that first moment, a little bit more visible, a bit bigger. After birth, the child grows further. But in the moment of the genes fuse is already the color of the child's eyes and the shape of his nose, and all that his body will be is coded for in that moment. In Torah, the process is always an organic unfolding. The first moment, the seed contains the whole tree. You don't see it yet. It needs time to be revealed. And therefore, wherever you look in Torah, the two examples that are obvious in Torah are the first word of the Torah, Bereshis, in the beginning, contains the whole Torah. All of human history is coded into that word. You know, there are many permutations of the letters of that word. Each permutation is another version of the beginning. The word Bereshit in Hebrew has six letters. They can be rearranged to spell, by the way, you don't even have to rearrange them. Bereshit spells bara shet. That means he created six. 6 days, six dimensions to the world. Bereshit. Or it spells Brit Esh, a covenant of fire. Or it spells Yirei Shabbat, which means the correct attitude towards Shabbat, which is the end of the process of creation. Or it spells Ba'alef Tishrei. Bereshit. Aleph B'Tishrei. On the first of Tishrei, which is when the world was created. Every which way you rearrange those letters is another word, because that is the first word. If it's the first word of the Torah, it contains the rest of the Torah. And if you're wise enough and deep enough, in that first word you could see the whole Torah. Just like if you know seeds, you can look at a little seed of a tree and know exactly what that tree will look like. A person looks at a little seed and he can tell you, in 20 years' time the tree will look like this, it'll have leaves like that. He's not seeing the future, he just knows seeds. That's how the Torah unfolds itself. And the Torah has two beginnings. It has a chronological beginning in the word Bereshis, which unfolds as history progresses. And it has a spiritual beginning in the word Anochim, the first of the Ten Commandments. And that's the meaning of the Ten Commandments. The Torah unfolds from a root. The ultimate root is the Aleph. Slightly expanded is the word Anochi, I am. Slightly more expanded is the first of the Ten Commandments, I am Hashem. Slightly more expanded, it's the Ten Commandments. And expanded fully, it's the whole Torah. And therefore, what we're doing in looking at the Ten Commandments, we're holding in our hand there, what he brought down from the mountain, was a set of root categories. And from each of these categories is derived another set. Strictly speaking, according to Kabbalistic teaching, there should have been 1,000. The Torah is always sets of 10. Right? So if there are 10 commandments at root, then there should have been 1,000 commandments, right? And I'm sure all you black belt Kabbalists are aware that in fact there are 1,000 lights in the world. The Kabbalistic sources say the world actually has 1,000 lights. But only 613 of them are visible or revealed in the lower world. Always the upper three, or 3.5, without going into the exact numbers now, are always in the head, which are not visible. They're only there in thought. And then you move into the body and you begin to reveal what was there in thought. And so out of the 1,000 original lights, there are 620 that are revealed in the world. 613 mitzvahs and 7 rabbinic mitzvahs, or 613 mitzvahs and 7 non-Jewish mitzvahs, right? You know, the non-Jewish world has 7 basic mitzvahs in the Torah, 7 of those, and 613, that makes the 620 what's known in the Kabbalistic writing as the Tarach Amudei Or, the 620 columns of light on which the world stands. I'm sure your minds have already raced ahead and realize that Tarach, 620, is the same word as Keter in Hebrew, right? Which means the crown. The crown always is the root. The king is the king because of the crown. True, it is above him. It isn't yet part of him, but it contains the root of all that he will represent in the world. By the way, if you count up the letters in the Ten Commandments, there's 620. Go home and do it. Count all the... run through the Ten Commandments in Yisro, and you'll find there's 620 letters that spell out the Ten Commandments, right? This is the root dimension of the revealed world of commandments, and therefore, that is the secret. So what we've learned so far this evening is that the Ten Commandments are not just a sample of the Torah. They are the root categories from which all else in the Torah is derived. Obviously, it takes only a moment to realize that these ten must themselves unfold from their beginning. And therefore, the first one, I am Hashem, obviously contains all ten. Let's just study that for a moment. You can put it like this. All positive commandments in the Torah are derived from I am Hashem. All negative commandments, you shall not do this or that, are derived from the second one, you shall have no other gods before me. Which means that every time you fulfill a positive command, not only are you fulfilling that command, you're also fulfilling the command of relating to Hashem. Let's call it faith, for lack of a better word in English. And that's clear. Why? When you hold a lulav, or you light Shabbos candles, or put on tefillin, or whatever commandment you're fulfilling, you're also fulfilling your relationship with Hashem, the one who commands you to do it. So every mitzvah automatically has two components. Is this correct? Yes? No? If your father asks you to please go out and buy him a drink. So when you buy him a drink, you're doing two actions here for your father. One is you're providing him with something to drink, and two, you're fulfilling his wish in the same action. When Hashem asks you to sit in the sukkah or eat matzah, when you do that, you're fulfilling two. You do the detail that he's asked you to do, and you're obeying his instruction, which is what faith really means. It means, I am Hashem. Yeah, relate to me. Every time you break a negative command, you're breaking two things. Right? When you damage something in the world, right, you're dishonest, or you... you break Shabbat, let's say. You eat something unkosher. So you're damaging that aspect of the world. You're damaging yourself. You're damaging your own spiritual structure. Unkosher food, for example, desensitizes you. And you're also breaking your relationship with the one who asked you not to do this. Now, if your father asks you not to do something, and you go do that thing. So not only are you doing the damage that he asked you not to do, you're also hurting him in your relationship. And therefore, obviously, there can be no greater or more all-encompassing negative command then don't have other gods. Every time you do something that he told you not to do, you're worshipping another god. Right? You're discarding your relationship with him. You're being disloyal in that relationship to him. And therefore, it should be clear that the first two commandments, the ones we heard from Hashem personally at the giving of the Torah, I am Hashem and don't have any others, obviously those are the roots. A moment's thought will also show you, of course, that even all the negative ones are enfolded back into the positive. The first of them all is a positive one, I am Hashem. Which means that every time you do a positive command, you're doing that and fulfilling this mitzvah. Every time you break a negative commandment, you're breaking three things. You're doing the damage in the world you shouldn't have done. You're worshipping another god by defecting and betraying your relationship with Hashem. By going against that. And you're also failing to fulfill the love and the faith and attachment you should have had back in the first one. Yeah. And that's how mitzvahs are unfolding, and that's why when you do one action, you can be fulfilling or breaking many mitzvahs. This leads to one more thought that's fundamental. Which are more important, the positive commands or the negative? Well, if the first of the commands in the Torah is I am Hashem, which is the root of all positive, and that contains everything, by definition, in some way, that must be more important. So how come the punishment for negatives is worse? The punishment for breaking positives, you did not put on tefillin, you did not say Shema, right? You didn't do what you should have done, you did not eat matzah, you didn't sit in a sukkah, you didn't put on tefillin, which is particularly serious from one perspective. Never put on tefillin. The punishments for those are less than the punishments for killing, stealing, kidnapping, adultery. Why? The answer is that, and here's a major key, the first commandment in the Torah, which is faith, let's call it emunah, relating to Hashem, the root of all positive commands, those are far more important than the negatives. When you fulfill a positive commandment, you build something in the spiritual world. When you fulfill a negative command, you don't build anything. Again, let's say you do a positive command. You sit in the sukkah, you eat matzah, right? You give charity, you give tzedakah, an interpersonal mitzvah or a man-god mitzvah. You build something in the spiritual world, you build a limb or organ, if you like, of the spiritual world. It sends down power which builds that limb or organ of your spiritual being and possibly your body as well. And that's what you construct. And when you leave this world, what you will exist in is that body that you built. That's what's been constructed. It's a building of the self and building of the universe. When you fulfill a negative command, you build nothing. Again, I see blank faces. When you eat matzah on Pesach, right, you take a lulav, you build a positive. When you fulfill, for example, you walk out of here tonight, lost in thought, I hope, and you walk down the main road, and you pass the local jewelry store, and you resist the temptation to pick up a brick that's lying on the pavement and throw it through the plate glass window and run off down the street with the goods, right? As you do on most Saturday nights. As you resist on most Saturday nights. You just then fulfill the negative commandment of thou shalt not steal. Come to think of it, sitting right here at this moment, you're fulfilling that mitzvah too. Nothing's been built in the spiritual world. When you fulfill, is this clear? When you observe a negative commandment, right, you don't build anything.
You're not destroying anything?
What?
Are you not destroying anything when you steal?
You are definitely destroying when you do. But when you fulfill the commandment, you observe the negative, you don't build. The secret is this. All human activity fits into two categories, love and fear. The right hand of drawing close and the left hand of resistance and pushing away. That's every human activity, every thought, everything you can ever do in the world is either a function of love and drawing close and bonding or a function of fear, rejection and pushing away. Everything. When you bring up a child, there are only two modes. There's the unconditional love you give the child and there's a discipline in saying no. When a child is educated, the child has only two characteristics that are meaningful. Consideration. That means self-control, don't interfere, don't harm others. And concern, get out and help. There are only two modes, the right hand and the left hand. Love and fear, or discipline, or self-control, or pushing away, or distancing. Sometimes they come together. You have a Torah teacher, right? Your relationship with your Torah teacher is supposed to be what's called kavod. Kavod means, no English word, let's call it honor. But the honor, that means the awe with, in which you hold your Torah teacher is a combination of two characteristics, love and fear. Somebody who's immensely developed in Torah, who's your spiritual teacher, who gives you an inheritance in the next world, who opens your eyes to what the world's all about. How do you feel about him? Unbelievable love and total awe. On the one hand, you love to be close to him. On the other hand, the closer you get, the more fearsome it is. Right? You can have mixed feelings. That's called kavod. Kavod is always a combination of right and left hands. But everything you ever do in the world will either be right in a relationship with a friend. There's the acts of love you do when you give your friend gifts and you express your feelings and you show them how you love them. And there's the negativity of not being disloyal to them, not hurting their feelings. Right? There's always those two categories. Now, which are the more important? The positive or the negative? The answer is the only important ones. The only ones that build the relationship are the love. The love, the acts of love. That's what builds the relationship. The not damaging the love just maintains and preserves what you have. Doesn't build it. I would say like this. Let's say you start a factory to produce, you want to manufacture, sell goods. So you build a factory. Your factory has two components. There's manufacturing and then there's security. You need an electric fence and guards outside with dogs and I don't know. You need to stop the bad forces getting in. That stuff doesn't help you produce anything. Just costs money. It's there to prevent damage. The purpose of the exercise is the production. Unfortunately, you need the negative. But it doesn't produce anything. On the contrary, it costs. When you get married, you have two aspects of a relationship with your wife. So one is the acts of love, the gifts, the bringing flowers on Friday, which is more than a gift. That's pikuach nefesh, you know, that's like your life depends on the family. You bring gifts, right? You show it. Then there's the control of self, which is not relating to other people in intimate fashion, not being disloyal. Which of those builds the relationship? Only the acts of love. When you show love and you do things for each other and you express your feelings to your spouse and you bring gifts, that builds the love. Right? And you can feel it. Right? If you come home on Friday afternoon with 12 very beautiful, very expensive red roses, you can have whatever you want. You can have whatever you want. Because it's... But try coming home and telling your wife that you wanted to cook you a special meal because you didn't spend the weekend with another woman. You're not going to get a special meal. Why? Because, on the other hand, being disloyal is much worse than not building the positivity. What does it mean to break a positive command? You didn't bring flowers. It's not good. But it's not as bad as giving someone else flowers. It's not as good as being. It's not as bad as being disloyal. Is this clear? And therefore, only the positive build your relationship with Hashem. But the punishments for the negatives are much worse. It's much worse to break down and be disloyal and smash than not yet to have built. And therefore, the punishments in the Torah for the negative commands are much more serious. Killing, stealing. Much more serious. To damage the world in that way, to damage the spiritual world. Much more serious. Than not having done the positive is not good, but hopefully you'll get there and do it. With very few exceptions. This is also the secret of a certain halachic principle, by the way. There's an amazing halachic principle called Ese Doche Lo Isas. Ese Doche Lo Ta'ase. Which means that if you have a positive and a negative commandment at the same time, what do? Let's say you have to do an action. The same action will fulfill a positive and break a negative. I don't think that's the first thought. I think the first thought is, how can you smash something in order to... But amazingly, example. Let's say you want to make tzitzis, right? So the law is you've got to put tzitzis on the garment. According to Torah law, you actually should put woolen tzitzis on a flax or linen garment. That's a transgression of what's called shaktus, right? You're not allowed to wear wool and linen bonded together. Okay? Today, by the way, we don't do this because we don't have the blue thread, so we can't fulfill the mitzvah correctly. But let's say you had authentic strings of tefillin. You could put the woolen tzitzis on a flax garment. As you put them on, or as you wear them, I'm not going to go into that discussion, as you fulfill the mitzvah, you are fulfilling the mitzvah of tzitzis and breaking the transgression of shatness. Yet you do it. Why? Because the principle is when you're fulfilling a positive command, in the same act, the negative disappears. Amazing. Another example. Let's say, today we don't have this, but let's say a person has on his body what we call saras, right? In English they translate it as leprosy, but it's not. It's a spiritual affliction. There's a prohibition to cut that off. Not allowed to cut that off from the body. It needs a spiritual healing. You can't cut it off. Let's say a child needs a bris, a circumcision, or an adult for that matter needs to be circumcised. And on the place of the circumcision is a speck of saras. So what's he going to do? Fulfill the incredible mitzvah of circumcision, but transgress the prohibition in the same act of cutting off this problem that you're not allowed to cut off. Answer, do it. Because in an act that fulfills a positive command, the negative disappears. Why? But with tonight's discussion, you can understand a little bit. The concept is that when your factory is producing, at the moment that you've achieved production, who needs the guards? They're irrelevant. Again, the guards and the protection and the defenses and all the stuff that you set up to stop damage is only relevant so you can get to production. But at the moment that the purpose has been achieved, the rest falls away. It's irrelevant. Is this clear? And therefore, that's the principle. The principle is that the first of the commandments is definitely the positive one. That's I am Hashem. That is why you're alive. You're not here so you don't worship other gods. You don't get married in order not to be disloyal, unless you are very twisted. You get married to build a love relationship with your wife. You don't get married to her not to be disloyal. It so happens that you must not be disloyal, because if you did, you'd be breaking down your relationship. You don't choose a friend so that you can not let him down. You choose a friend to build a relationship and a love relationship with your friend. As it happens, you must respect him and not hurt him, not break it down. But that's not the point of the exercise. That guards what you've built. And therefore, that is the order. The first of the commandments in the Torah is, I am Hashem. That's why you're here. That's the definition of the relationship. All other mitzvahs fulfill that. Secondly, is a warning. Don't go to the wrong source. Don't worship others. Don't break down. Don't be disloyal. Right? Don't damage the relationship that we built. That's second. That's only a protection or a guard for what's been built. With that introduction, let's take a look this evening at just the first level of understanding. What is this first mitzvah of Emunah? Now that we've said that it's the root of all 10, it's the root of all 613, of all 1,000 if you like, it is the root of the existence of the world. Right? It stands on, if you like, a relationship with Hashem. And that's what we call Emunah. So let's spend a few minutes, beginning at least, a study of this mitzvah. We call it in English faith, right? Faith. Faith, belief, faith. Let's try and develop at least, hopefully we'll have chance together to go through all 10 of the commandments and see how they relate and see each one's uniqueness and see how the first 5 parallel the second 5. But let's make a start this evening and try, with the background we've established, to make some inroads into understanding what this mitzvah is. And I think the easiest way to understand it is to get it is to understand what's wrong in the conventional translation. We usually call emunah faith or belief, and that's an extremely problematic concept. That is not the concept of blind faith or belief is not a Jewish concept. Let me try to explain why and suggest a different direction. In English, the concept of faith means relating to something that you cannot know. Belief. That's why it's English. It's called blind faith. A leap of faith. Blind belief. Jewish thinking is that if something's completely blind, why should you do it? Why should you wake up in the morning sort of born again believing? On what basis? Emotional? Again, the problem is, if there's no objective verification of this thing, why should you believe it? Especially something as important as this that you build your life on, you might have to die for. But the problem is, if you can establish facts, and you can demonstrate why this is logical, then why call it belief? Then call it knowledge. Do you see the problem? If you translate emunah as belief, the problem that raises is, if it is truly blind belief, blind faith, why should I do it? And there's no question that in English, faith and belief mean blindness. The fact that you're sitting here this evening is something that I don't believe. That's an inappropriate word. I know it, as far as a human being can know anything. What's on the other side of that wall, I have to believe. I can't see it. I have to believe it. If God's existence and all that comes with it, which might mean your life, if that's based on purely emotional decision to believe, what's it worth? And by the way, if it is based on that, then you can never discuss or debate religion at all, because believe whatever you want. If you believe something that has no factual basis, and you get into a discussion with somebody else, and his system has no factual basis, what are you going to say? He believes it because he believes it. I believe the opposite of yours. I suppose that's cool too. By the way, that is the attitude in Western thinking. The attitude in the West is whatever you believe is okay. You can't debate it. It's personal. But that completely trashes the notion of any objectivity. If you're so open-minded that everybody can believe whatever they want, you're talking about making nonsense of the whole thing. Is this clear? Yes? No? If you have a religious discussion with somebody who believes exactly the opposite of what you believe, he believes the Messiah has come already, and he knows who he is, and you believe he hasn't, and you're a really tolerant, liberal, Western, open-minded individual, so you each agree that each other's belief is cool. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. One's got to be wrong. If that's your attitude, that you can believe whatever you want and it's all okay, you make nonsense of the whole... That's not the Jewish attitude.
Well, maybe
the Jewish...
Sorry. Can be relevant for special...
But you'll be wrong.
...specific people, and not for... They can talk to someone, not talk to someone else.
But we talk about truth here. If two people believe mutually exclusive ideas...
Well, truth, what is it? Like something concrete that is in a
box. Doesn't have to be concrete to be real.
In a box.
It doesn't have to be
concrete in his head, and...
But that's exactly what I'm saying. If it's concrete in his head, he's got concrete in his head. I'm trying to establish here that we want something outside of your head. If God's only in his head, and in the next person's head, it's something else, so then there's nothing to talk about. That's not the Jewish idea. That is not the Jewish idea. The Jewish claim, the Torah claim, is that there's an objective fact out there. And saying whether you do or don't believe in it is as silly as saying that this particular drug will have such an effect if you drink it. You know, there's an objective fact there. It's not up to whether you believe it or not. So here's the problem. If Hashem's existence and the giving of the Torah and Jewish history and all these things, if they are established as fact, then let's talk about knowledge. Why call it belief? And if it is purely belief, just an emotional position, then we want no relationship with it. So here's the Jewish approach. The Torah axiom is that it's objective. It's objective, and you can come to know it. Let me just make one precondition here. When I say you can come to know something, I mean only as far as you can know anything. The incredibly important introduction here is that the human mind is not capable of knowing anything absolutely. In any discussion of religion or God's existence, you should never use the word proof. Beginners often use the word proof, and that's misleading, because there's no proof. What we're looking for is not proof, but evidence. Evidence there is. Good evidence. Extremely good evidence. Is 100% evidence which equals proof? No. But the reason for that is, not because God's existence is more shaky than anything else, but because there's nothing you can know with absolute certainty. The human mind is not capable of absolute certainty. If it were, you'd probably have no free will. All you ever get in life is adequate knowledge. You never get absolute knowledge. And that's very easy to demonstrate. Take a simple example. Are you awake right now? I mean, those of you who are. Are you awake right now? What do you say? Okay. Are you sure? Are you absolutely sure? No. You might be at home, in bed, dreaming that you're listening to an incredible discussion in the JLE, and you completely... The fact that you feel awake doesn't alter the situation one bit. When you're dreaming, you think you're awake. That's why you can go through absolute ecstasy or total abject terror in a dream. Right? If you knew you were dreaming, you'd be enjoying it. You pay to go see a horror movie, don't you? I hope not, but some people do. If you know you're dreaming, you'd enjoy the show. But you, when you're dreaming, you think you're awake. And therefore, how can you be sure you're awake now? I mean, this shouldn't bother you. You know, if it bothers you seriously, you need therapy, you know. But the point is that you can never know anything absolutely. One of the great philosophers of the last century pointed out that you can't even know that the world is more than 5 minutes old. Maybe the universe popped into existence 5 minutes ago with all your memories in place. Is that possible? It's possible. This shouldn't bother you, okay, because it's irrelevant, but it's possible. The human mind is not capable of absolute knowledge. And by the way, even life and death matters. When you trust your life to a pilot on a plane, or to a surgeon in surgery, or medicine, or anything, or you do something really dangerous like get married, whatever it is that you do, right? You trust your life to a situation, you can only do it on the basis of evidence. You can never do it on the basis of absolute proof. How much proof? How much evidence? How close can you get to proof? You only have a right to ask when someone says to me, give me religious proof. Give me, I just want one little miracle. As if that would be proof. But give me one. That person is being dishonest and unrealistic. Because there's no other area of their life in which they can ask for that. Because it's not available. When somebody says, I'm prepared to accept 80% or 90% or 95% proof when it comes to undergoing surgery, taking a medication, flying in a plane, whatever, crossing the street, whatever it is, he has only a right to ask me for 95% evidence in religion. And that I can supply. But when he wants 95% evidence in the rest of his life because he can't do better in religion, he wants 100%, you can't speak to such a person. Because it's unrealistic and it's not available. That person probably is not looking for evidence, he's probably choosing to reject. And therefore, through this whole discussion of faith, we are not claiming to produce proof. We're claiming to suggest evidence, but evidence at least as good as forces action or leads you to action in other areas of your life. Is that clear? So the Jewish claim is there's evidence. The evidence is good enough to act on. Not 100%, but good enough to act on. And then the question becomes, why do we call it faith? Call it knowledge. Call it knowledge as good as knowledge gets. And here's the key. And just one theme I want to try to develop a little bit this evening. We take it further, perhaps another occasion. The word emunah does not translate as faith. It's a Christian, Western, emotional, mistaken translation. The Hebrew word, of course, it has a seed of truth in it, like all false notions. It wouldn't have existed so long if it didn't. There is a seed of truth. We'll have to discuss that. But the real main translation of the word emunah is not faith, but faithfulness. The word loyalty or faithfulness fits it much better. Anyone who knows Hebrew knows that the word emunah is based on the root, the same root as ne'eman. Ne'eman means faithful, loyal, right? Yetev ne'eman means a peg that's dug so deep into the wall that you can hang your weight on it. That's called yetev ne'eman. It's a fixed point that you can rely on, right? Emunah means something that is reliable, that you can rely on, that will not let you down. It's got nothing to do with blind belief. It means establishing knowledge and then remaining faithful to the knowledge. Are you going to be loyal to this knowledge? That's the test. First of all, let me prove that to you textually. Look through the text of the Torah. You'll see that wherever the Torah uses the word emunah, it does not mean belief. Example, Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu is holding his hands up in the battle against the Amalek. You remember that? So it says he held his hands up. V'hayu yadav emunah ad ba hashamesh. His hands were emunah until the sun went down. His hands were faith. They were faithful. They stayed put. There's no way you can... Is this clear? There's no way you can translate that word as belief. You're talking about hands. It means his hands were faithful. Ne'eman. That means they stayed put even when he got tired and he had a hand hold them up. The word in Torah always means faithfulness. It does not mean faith or belief or blind belief. It's got nothing to do with that. Now the question is, why do you need this faithfulness? To what? After all, if you have knowledge, of course you'll be faithful to the knowledge, won't you? I mean, if you know something clearly, enough, as close to 100% as it gets, aren't you going to be faithful to the knowledge? And the answer is no. And here's the key. The way faith is set up, emunah is set up in Torah is like this. There are two components to it. One is called truth, and one is called faith. Or better, MS, truth, and emunah, loyalty to the truth. The Zohar puts it like this. The great Kabbalistic source work says like this. Truth is male, and faith is female. In the language of the Zohar, four words. I hu emet, that means he is truth. Ve I hi emunah, and she is faithfulness. The mystical concept is like this. There's a male quality, not talking here men and women. That's more distant. We're talking the root in the world of maleness is a faculty that establishes truth. That's why Hashem is always referred to as male, because he is truth. The world is always female. All Hebrew words for the earth and the world are female. Because the earth is created in loyalty to Hashem. The Medrash says when Hashem created the world, amazing Medrash. It says, He'emin ba'olamo or bra'o. In English it translates as, he believed in his world and created it. Amazing concept. But it means he was loyal to that. That means the world was created in perfect loyalty to the idea. It maps perfectly to the desire until we mess it up. But the world is inherently a perfect model of his desire. And therefore, there are two faculties, truth and loyalty to the truth. And the work in the world is to establish both. First, you have to get clear. You have to establish truth. As long as you bamboozled and vague and all, you can't develop spiritually. First, clarification, evidence, and then live up to the evidence. How you get the evidence, I'm not going to discuss this evening. There's evidence, that's another discussion. But what I want to talk about briefly is, what is this work of loyalty to the knowledge? And here's the problem. Human beings are created in such a way that you can have clear knowledge and be completely disloyal to your knowledge. People don't think so. They think if I knew something clearly, of course I would do it. Ever tried dieting? Ever tried dieting? Let me describe it to you. This is how a diet works. You've got two options, right? On the one hand, there's your diet. And it's very clear. Very clear. This is how I want to look. This is how I want to be. My future depends on this. My marriage, relationship, next summer on the Kosher beach. I mean, it's like, this is important, right? Clear. Doesn't get clearer than that. On the other hand is this little chocolate wedge thing with a few cherries and a bit of cream and nonsense, nothing. Nothing to do. A 10-year-old wouldn't fall for that. This is what you don't want to do. So you've got on the one hand your diet, which is very important and very clear. On the other hand, you've got 10 seconds of childish, ridiculous pleasure during which you're going to feel like an idiot. And 2 minutes later you find you're looking at a plate that is clean. It's like not even a... How do you do that? The problem was lack of clarity? You didn't see it clearly enough? Of course you saw it clearly. How do you? People make a mistake. They think if I really see it clearly, of course I'll do it. No, doesn't work that way. Here's an example that made a very deep impact on me. When I was a young intern in surgery, so I had, in the hospital where I was working, one day we got a patient who had Berger's disease. This disease is not that uncommon. You see it from time to time. Every major hospital, you'll see it. People who have this disease are uniquely susceptible to the nicotine in cigarette smoke. If they smoke, their blood vessels close down. They're exquisitely sensitive to the constrictive effect of nicotine. First, their fingers fall off. No blood supply to their fingers. The fingers fall off. Then their hands fall off. Okay? Their body falls apart. There's not one recorded case in a non-smoker. It's 100% connected to the smoking. As soon as they stop smoking, the disease stops. They carry on smoking, the disease progresses. He was a 45-year-old, highly intelligent engineer, and he came into our ward with a blue leg, because the main artery supplying his leg was closing down, his leg was going blue, and he knew that if he carried on smoking, we'd have to cut his leg off. But he knew, above knee amputation. The man carried on smoking, we cut his leg off. The next time I saw him was a year later. He was being wheeled down the hospital corridor in a wheelchair with no legs, smoking, on his way to losing an arm. Now, just let's get that clear. Man stands there with a cigarette and a leg, and he says to himself, what are my options? Throw away the cigarette and live? Leg? Walk? Man? Husband? Leg? Or 30 seconds of pleasure during which you'll feel the cold hand of death? How could you get that wrong? How could you get that wrong? What's going on in the mind that does that? You think he forgot about the fact that this is going to happen to him? He knows it. He knew it better than we did. What's going on? The human problem is that you can see a thing clearly and you can betray your own knowledge. And the really humiliating thing is as soon as you've done it, you see it. You say to yourself, how did I do that? The problem is there are two faculties. There's a faculty of clarification. That's called truth. But then there's a faculty of loyalty to the truth. It's a different thing entirely. They're as different as male and female. Let me tell you, there's an amazing description. Well, we'll finish with this maybe. There's an amazing description of this in a work called the Aruch. Listen carefully to this. It's an amazing life lesson. The Aruch is an ancient Talmudic dictionary. Fascinating work. But the Aruch has the following story, talking many centuries ago. It's called the story of the Bor and the Chulda. The background and what it means, and Kabbalistically, I'm not going to go into, but let's tell you the story. It's called the story of the Bor and the Chulda. Bor means a pit, and a Chulda is a like a ferret or a wildcat, some sort of dangerous small animal, right? So here's the story. And again, we don't have time to go into the details, but think it through yourself. Look it up. The Maharal has a wonderful analysis of the story where he explains all the symbolism and all the details. But I'll tell you briefly what it says. There was a young woman who was going to visit her father. She was dressed in her beautiful clothes, she had wearing her jewelry, and as she traveled to visit her father, she strayed into a wilderness. And in that desert she got lost and accidentally fell into a bor. She couldn't climb out, a completely deserted place. She would have died. She began crying, and as it happened, a young man was walking by. She was a Jewish girl. He happened to be a young Jewish man. He was a Kohen, in fact. In this desert, he heard a girl cry. He walked over to the pit, and he looked in, and he saw at the bottom of the pit. He said, "Who are you?" So she said her name. He said, "Are you human?" So she said, "Yes." He thought she was one of the Twilight Zone creatures of the desert. He said to her, swear that you're human." So she made an oath. By the way, some of the commentaries point out, how's swearing that you're telling the truth help? Isn't a liar going to swear? But to swear in Judaism, you need to use Hashem's name. The dark forces cannot say those names. So when she made a valid oath, he knew she was telling the truth. Then he said to her, "If I save you, will you marry me?" You have to listen very carefully. This is maleness speaking. Clarification, who are you? Make a proof. So she said, sure. She didn't have much choice, did she? So he lifted her out of the pit, and he wanted to marry her on the spot. So she said, that's not decent. That's not how we behave. I will go back to my town and get ready for the wedding. You go back to yours and you get ready. Then you come and meet my parents. And then we'll get married. So he agreed. And then they decided to make a pact between them, a covenant, right? What you call a vort, a bris. But in Judaism, to make a legally binding contract, you need witnesses. And there were no witnesses. They were in the desert. So they decided to take the only two things that they could use as witnesses. The pit itself, the boar, and a wild cat, a cholder, that was running past. They declared to each other, these will be our witnesses. And they promised to each other, they get married, and they made a commitment. She went back to her town and started getting ready for the wedding. He went back to his town and forgot about her. Again, I hate to say this, but we're talking male and female here. In fact, the way the Aruch puts it is very cruel. It says she went back to her town and began getting ready, and it's kevan she'avar mipaneh, which means as soon as she was out of sight, he forgot. So it says. Sometime later, he met another woman. He got married. Sometime later, she became pregnant and had a child. The child fell into a bore and died. Subsequently, she became pregnant again. She had another child. The child was eaten by a chulda. So she turned to her husband and she said, this is bizarre. What's going on? And he remembered the story of the bore and the chulda. And he told her exactly what had happened those years before. And she said to him, fine, now you divorce me. And you go back to the town that girl said she came from and you go find her. You see, it's a woman who's waiting and it's a woman who's teaching him. So the Aruch says he divorced her, and he went back to the town that he remembered, and he walked in and he managed to find her father, and the father said, unfortunately, you can no longer see her. She's lost her mind. She's insane. Anyone goes near her, she shreds their clothes. She's insane. He begged to be allowed to see her. As he walked into the room, she started shredding his clothing, behaving in an insane fashion, and he said to her, Bora and Chulda, and she revealed to him that she'd be pretending to be insane so that no one else could marry her. And they got married, and the Aruch says they had a happy life together, they had children. What's being said here? There's a male faculty of clarification. What is the male clarification? He is truth, establishing it, and instant gratification, by the way, and no staying power at all, no faculty of loyalty. Immediate clarification, immediate results. Femaleness, no clarification at all. Hopeless, she gets lost in a desert. Hopeless, doesn't know where she's going. But staying power, loyalty. No matter what she promised, she's there. There are two opposite characteristics. There's MS, truth. That's a hard job. You have to be a perfect male for that. And there's Ne'emonis. There's the loyalty to the truth. For that, you have to be a perfect woman. And you need both. To be a fulfilled Jew, you need a head. You need to think. You need evidence. You need clarification. But then you need to move it down here. Which means that you have to walk the walk. This does not lead to this. The distance from here to here is a long way. You can be a very clarified individual and act in total disloyalty to your knowledge. Let me finish with a story. Of course, there's a lot more to say, but let me leave you with a story to think about. The story of the Bor and the Chulda is an allegorical Torah idea. Let me leave you with a real-time practical example, and we'll stop there for this evening. As an introduction to the Ten Commandments, the concept of faith as loyalty. Here's the story. In 1942, the Japanese invaded the Philippines. 1944, the war was coming to an end. The Japanese left. But something very strange continued in the Philippines. A Japanese officer had got left behind. His name was Lieutenant Onoda. And he carried on fighting his own private war. In his uniform with his gun, he killed 30 Filipinos. On his own. Right? And this went on for 30 years. 30 years. And they couldn't find him. In 1974, I think he was about 20 years old when the story began. In 1974, the Japanese government decided to do, Filipinos were still dying. They sent a certain Major Suzuki, Japanese officer, to find him. And he found him in his original uniform, with his gun, stalking the jungles for 30 years. He said to him, Onoda, it's time to go home. Onoda said, I'm not going home, I'm carrying out my orders. I was given instructions by my commanding officer to fight to the death with no surrender. That's what I'm doing. He said to him, that was 30 years ago. He said, what's the difference? I was given orders. I'm being loyal to my instructions as a soldier. He said to him, but you're being illogical. Onoda said to him, a soldier's duty is not to be logical. It's to do what he's ordered to do. If every soldier starts thinking logically, you've got no army. So he said to him, do you know that the war's over? He said, I'm not a fool, of course. He said, the war's over, what are you doing? He said, I'm being loyal to my task. My commanding officer gave me an order. That's what I'm doing. He could not convince him to go home. Suzuki went back, and the Japanese Admiralty got together, and they made a plan. They found an elderly officer who'd been present at the time of the evacuation. They sent him back in uniform with an original Japanese demobilization order. He found him in the jungle and called him to attention, and read him the original Japanese order to go home. Onoda handed over his gun, and he went back to Japan. The Filipinos called him a hero, and they bought him a new blue suit. It's a very emotional story, by the way. He arrived back at Tokyo. Thousands of people came to meet him, including his own family that he hadn't seen for 30 years. He left the pre-war Japan and came back to an industrialized... amazing story. Now, just imagine this. Imagine you go and find him in the jungle, and you tell him to come home, and he says no. And you say to him, but you're crazy. You're being illogical. And he says to you, talk about emunah. Talk about faithfulness. Talk about loyalty. Doesn't get better than that. On the other hand, there's something desperately wrong here. Something desperately wrong. Right? What's his mistake? So, I mentioned this to a group of young high school students in London some time ago. And I said to them, what was he doing wrong? And one young girl put up her hand and she said, he had emunah, but he did not have emet. Exactly right. Loyalty, you can't fault. Talk about loyalty. But to what? And as a Jew, you need both. You need male and female. You need clarification. The Torah process is questioning and critical thinking. The first faculty you need to develop is a taste for objectivity. The first technique of Torah study, of Talmudic study, is to learn to criticize and critique and question critically. But that's not enough to make a human being out of you. Having it up here is not enough. It's necessary, but it's not enough. There are two aspects to being a fulfilled and spiritual person. One is objectivity and clarification, to see reality as it is, whether it's painful or not. And then there's bringing it from the head to the heart and making sure you live up to it. Okay, we'll stop there for this evening.